Serial Killing, a podcast, is researched, written, produced, and hosted by me, Alyssa Carroll. This is an independent production, no network, no contracts, and I need your support. Please subscribe, follow on my socials linked below, or go to my Patreon to show your support. Thank you so much.
Hi, listeners. I'm Vanessa Richardson, host of the podcast Serial Killers. Like many of you, I'm fascinated by the darker side of humanity. What causes someone to develop such deadly desires and why they decide to act on them? For the past 6 years, I've been able to explore these curiosities weekly, tapping into the mental states of the world's most notorious killers, examining their backgrounds and habits, searching for answers. If you haven't had a chance to check out our show, there's truly no better time to dive in. With hundreds of episodes to binge and new ones released weekly, Serial Killers is the perfect podcast for any avid true crime fan. Follow Serial Killers on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts.
From about 15 years on up, a great deal of my thoughts were basically unshareable.
We are all evil in some form or another. Yes, I am evil. Not 100%, but I am evil.
My mother was a sick, angry, hungry, and very sad woman. I hated her, but I wanted to love my mother.
This is Serial Killing, a podcast.
Hello again, guys, and welcome back to Serial Killing, a podcast, where we sometimes, kind of often, veer off the serial killer path to delve into other topics within our beloved true crime community. And side note, if I had known that I was going to love to do other true crime stuff besides serial killers, I probably would have chosen a different name, but I digress. Special thanks to my patrons who voted for this episode and who get early access to each podcast. Thank you so much, guys. You are truly appreciated. They did a really big vote, or they've got a really big kind of voting poll over there on Patreon right now, so it's going to be a month's worth of content for me. Now, today's podcast will be part two of the disappearance of Alyssa Turney. In part one, which I will link in the notes, we went over Alyssa's stepfather slash adopted father, Michael Turney. He is absolutely vital in Alyssa's story. So again, go listen to part one if you haven't. I highly recommend it. So last week where we left off, April 5th, 1996, just after Alyssa's 12th birthday, Alyssa's late mother, Barbara's sister, Teresa, contacted Child Protective Services, and the report that Sarah read on her podcast said, quote, "Father Michael reportedly abuses prescription drugs and drinks alcohol daily, which makes him sleep most of the day and night. He has also written at least two suicide notes." Teresa told them that the home was a mess and that there was no food in the home to eat. The family is in the process of being evicted because the father is too proud to sign up for food stamps. Mother died from cancer a few years ago. 18-year-old John lives in the home currently, but will be moving out. Teresa is concerned about the children once John leaves. End quote. Now, the detective kind of notated, "It should be noted that no allegations of sexual abuse are made in this complaint, but in various phone conversations, Mike Turney characterizes this complaint as alleging he, quote, beat up and raped Alyssa," end quote. Included are numerous letters Michael wrote in response to these allegations, stating Teresa was sexually abused as a child and currently uses drugs. He also files a false police report with the Phoenix PD. Michael also stated that Stephen, Alyssa's biological father, raped her when she was so little, which of course we know is not true. Again, I must really kind of drive this home. Michael was very upset about Teresa calling CPS, and he made frantic phone calls, clearly scared that CPS was coming. He even began calling the attorney general in his panicked and paranoid state. The ex-girlfriend slash teacher told Alyssa that it was best to keep things that happened in the home private. This is one that Alyssa told that she was having sex with her father when she was just 9 years old. This is her former third grade teacher. So Sarah Turney, who is Alyssa's little sister, has a podcast, as I've said before. It's called Voices for Justice. She talks on her podcast about her father giving her triazolam in the evenings to help her sleep. This drug is used to treat insomnia. It is in the benzodiazepine family of drugs that can make a person experience memory loss, impaired judgment, paranoia, and suicidal ideation. It can also slow breathing and cause death. Anyone under 18 years old is not generally prescribed this, and yet Michael was giving her, Sarah, the adult dose of a benzo. I wonder why. Moving on. As Alyssa was beginning puberty, Michael began to complain about her becoming promiscuous at 12 years old. I mean, she clearly wasn't. He was still writing various suicide notes that were later found. And let's not forget that he told his former lover and, again, Alyssa's former third grade teacher that one day Alyssa would be someone that men would, quote, have great sex with, and that she needed to be, quote, spayed. None of these things were ever reported by that teacher. I still cannot wrap my mind around that. I would have called the police so fast. And just as Alyssa's older brother, John, they shared their mother, Barbara, was about to move out and on with his life, sources say that Michael forced him to sign a statement that said Alyssa was never sexually abused. Again, what? According to Brooke Justina at WordPress, this is a direct quote from that website. When Alyssa was middle school age, their cousin David came to live with them. Mike admitted to David that he had tied Alyssa to a chair because she was out of control. Alyssa told David that her dad had handcuffed her to her bed. David came home from work one night and put in a VHS tape marked Dr. Doolittle that instead was a home movie from the Turney home showing two girls, one of which was Alyssa, unconscious, naked from the waist up, with their eyes, both girls' eyes, were covered by a newspaper. When David found this, he left and he never spoke to his uncle again. Alyssa and Sarah's Uncle James said that he was aware of this, that this tape existed, and that he had heard of another one that showed Alyssa having sex with Mike and an unknown adult woman. Kind of makes me think it might be the third grade teacher, but these tapes have not been recovered. So that was all from that source. Now, on Sarah's podcast, David speaks about this. She actually interviews him. He noticed that his uncle had hundreds of videotapes. He stated it was eerily quiet on the tape. He fast-forwarded and found other scenes on the tape. He was so shocked, he left the tape in the VCR. He left the house immediately. He went back a few days later and could not look Michael in the face to get most of his stuff. But, you know, he was in such a hurry, he even forgot some of his stuff. He told his mother, and yet CPS was not called. So an older brother, James, later stated that there was another tape where it showed Michael having sex with Alyssa. James told their grandmother, and he stated the grandmother was not at all shocked. And yet, again, predictably, no calls to CPS, of course. Then it became rather common knowledge that Michael had hidden cameras in the vents to film Alyssa at any point in time during the day. Alyssa's friends and the third grade teacher, as well as Barbara's BFF, all knew about the cameras in the vent in her bedroom and elsewhere. So this is on top of recording every single call, ingoing and outgoing. Now, Michael later confessed in a statement recovered later by the police, stating he was too far putting the cameras in the vents, that he had gone too far putting the cameras in the vents. Alyssa and Michael began to fight terribly, slamming doors and whatnot, and Sarah, being, you know, younger, didn't really understand what was going on, so she shut herself in her room to try to block most of it out. So a lot of this she was not entirely aware of. Now, a friend of Alyssa's stated that in her early teens, she was outgoing and fun. Only she stated that Alyssa began asking to spend the night at her house rather than going home. When Alyssa would call her to chat, she would keep the conversation very superficial, and of course we all know why. But she told her friend that she was not comfortable at home or talking about personal things over the phone because she knew her father was filming and recording nearly everything. It made Alyssa feel separated from her peers, as she didn't have the freedom and privacy to make normal teenage mistakes. And this is really all part of growing up, and Alyssa just didn't have that. Now, Michael disapproved of Alyssa having this friend, even drafting a contract to give to her friend's parents' house involving Alyssa attending a birthday party at their house, okay? It says that they will provide constant adult supervision while Alyssa was there. They were to agree that there would be no alcohol, drugs, or sex going on at the party. No male children or male adults would be allowed to sleep over. They had to agree that Alyssa would not be allowed to leave their house. Are you kidding me? The way around Michael's surveillance was to write letters to her friends, and Alyssa did that, and her friends kept them. She spoke about how horrible they fought. She said that Michael complained about even taking her to school. So 15-year-old Alyssa told friends that she was afraid she and Sarah would be separated by CPS. She told her friends that her home life was bad, but she was scared CPS would separate her and Sarah. Michael stated that one of the older boys of his told him he called CPS after Alyssa had confided in him, but Alyssa knew that her brother would never rat her out. That just would not happen, never. Now, when asked, Michael stated that the brother had told him that Alyssa said they all three, him and the two girls, slept in Michael's bed together, which of course Sarah knew was not true. Sarah remembers on May 19th of the year 2000, the last day of her sophomore year, Michael and Alyssa were driving alone in North Phoenix. And as he had done with Barbara and his ex-girlfriend, he got off the highway, went to a deserted place where he attempted to sexually assault Alyssa. And that is what she told her older brother. She told the brother she had to get out and escaped. This brother would later state that he was 100% afraid of his father. So after this incident, Michael forced her to sign a contract stating that she swore under no duress, which is, side note, laughable, that her father had never physically or sexually abused her at any time. She had to sign this saying he never offered her marijuana or any other drugs not prescribed by a doctor. It also said that Alyssa swore she had never had sex herself or had ever molested her little sister, which is completely fucking random. There was a lot of sexual description in this contract that get super personal. So May 22nd, 2000, sources say that $2,000 was taken out of Alyssa's bank account, withdrawn by Michael, with yet another strange call to CPS by Michael himself, the report of which states, quote, Alyssa Turney, 16, and Sarah Turney, 11, live with their father, Michael Turney. Michael is the adoptive father of Alyssa and the biological father of Sarah. Barbara Turney, biological mother of both girls, died in 1993. Alyssa and father got into an argument because she wanted to go to a party and father would not allow it. Alyssa threatened father, saying she would call CPS and say father was molesting her if he did not allow her to attend the party. She also wanted to get her tongue pierced, get a tattoo, and drive the family car. Alyssa told father she hates the lifestyle that he and Sarah led because they are boring. Mike Turney would like Alyssa's threats to CPS noted. There is no report taken as there is no allegation of abuse or neglect. End quote. So the next day, Michael writes up another contract, notarized, on May 23rd, 2000, signed by Michael, one of his sons, and a public notary. There is a line for Alyssa to sign, but the words, quote, no identification, are there. 13 points with the initials AT are on each point. The overall contract talked about giving temporary custody to son Michael, Michael's son Michael, due to Alyssa being incorrigible. That was the word. She refuses to come home. Son has agreed to take custody while Alyssa simmers down, so to speak. Michael states that her refusal has nothing to do with alcohol abuse, neglect, sexual or physical abuse. Boy, he just brings that up a lot, doesn't he? Lack of food or clean housing and so on. It was stated that she would no longer try to talk Friends' parents into letting her stay over, that she would never smoke pot again, that she will never bring a male friend into her father's house without his consent, and that she would discontinue any bisexual acts while living with her father. The contract ended, stating Alyssa would no longer harass or treat differently Michael or Sarah. I mean, this is just crazy stuff. If she refused to follow any of these new rules, he would turn her over to the juvenile authorities. That was his threat. So after Alyssa was gone for a week, and this was after he'd taken her to the desert and he'd tried to get her, you know, Michael wrote a letter to Alyssa reminding her of what she agreed to. He spoke about his frustrations, stating, if you don't love me, I cannot and will not make you, but I am still responsible and accountable for your safety, blah, 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 and on, right? So he claimed he told her he loved her and that she would not say it back. And I don't really believe in forcing children to say those words if they're not comfortable with them. So it's the absolute desperation to maintain total control over Alyssa for me. His feeble attempts at contacting CPS to say she's basically a wild animal, completely out of control, are very telling, considering no one that knew her said anything about her being wild. They all said she was a normal teenager. Contract after contract were drafted by Michael just to try to cover his tracks for what we all are pretty convinced he was doing to her. So I'm going to need you guys to kind of sit down for the next bit, okay? This signing over temporary physical custody to his son wasn't for Alyssa to have some cooling off period. It was so that, as Michael said, he would then take Sarah and move to Mexico. And then, of course, this didn't happen. It sounds very much like he wanted to flee to me. And Michael somehow had Alyssa on an individualized education plan for a learning disability that she did not have. He regularly told her that she was stupid. He forced her to ride the short bus. He said she was, quote, dumber than a rock, and said she had a mild form of retardation. Amazing. He would call her that word frequently. He constantly told her that she needed special accommodations because she was slow. Again, all of this just to cover his own ass. Because if he convinced the authorities and everyone around her that she was slow, learning disabled, wild, out of control, you know, drinking and doing drugs, slinging leg, left and right, boys or girls, bisexual, you know, then, you know, anything that she said about his horrific abuse of her would be sort of muddied through that lens, if that makes sense. It blurs the lens through which anyone would see her. It's the absolute gaslighting for me. So Alyssa began working in a local fast food restaurant, and Michael sure was there. There is footage of Michael filming Alyssa through the window while she's working. It very much feels like he's literally stalking her. And then she got a fairly serious boyfriend, and Michael filmed her through the vent in the living room, innocently making out with her boyfriend on the couch. I don't think they were doing anything major, maybe some smooches, some petting, nothing major. So then after that, Michael asked one of Sarah's best friends to help him hire a prostitute to use as a means of breaking Alyssa and her boyfriend up. It came across as him being incredibly jealous and also scared of what else she might tell people about what Michael had been doing to her since she was a small child. It seemed fairly obvious that, as Alyssa got older and braver, Michael pushed even harder to not only devalue her, but to push everyone else away from her and keep her to himself, or at least isolate her. And as Sarah was becoming an adolescent herself, again, the different treatment the girls got became kind of glaringly obvious because Sarah was allowed to come and go as she pleased. She said this herself. She had no such rules and regulations. Sarah would tell you that she was becoming far more wild and rebellious than Alyssa ever had, and yet Michael allowed every bit of it, all while forcing Alyssa to sign these insane contracts and, you know, so on. So, apparently there was also a second desert incident in which he again drove her out to a remote area in the desert and tried to assault her, and she fought, but this time he made her walk all the way home. Michael then stated that Alyssa had a very high sex drive and that she very much enjoyed engaging in such activities. Disgusting. But in all, Michael knew time was running out. Alyssa then started her junior year in the fall of 2000. In early 2001, sources stated that Michael purchased 50 pounds of lime compound and 60 pounds of concrete with zero explanation. It was also said that he owned two identical trucks, but his family only knew about one of them. Another source said he sold one truck and bought an identical one. Either way, that would be super convenient to conceal evidence, don't you think? And that brings us to the day that she disappeared. And I say that with air quotes, the day she, air quotes, disappeared. So the last day of Alyssa's junior year, May 17th, 2001, it started like any other day in that Alyssa got up, got ready for school, and Michael dropped her and Sarah off at school. Sarah was enjoying her last day of seventh grade and was going to be able to go on a field trip to a water park. Fun stuff. Sometime between 10:30 and 11 a.m., Alyssa stuck her head into her boyfriend's shop class to tell him that she would be seeing him later at a youth gathering, like party something. It is known that Michael went to the school to check Alyssa out and take her to lunch. And that's it. No one would ever see Alyssa again. We know Michael was late picking Sarah up from school, so she went home with a friend, and her father picked her up from there around 5 p.m.-ish. Sarah says it was about 5. So if we do the math, that is somewhere around, 6 hours, give or take, where Michael's whereabouts could not be verified. Now, he says after he dropped the girls off at school, or after he picked Alyssa up and they went to have lunch, he dropped her off at the house to cool off, and we'll get into that in a second, and then he just ran errands the whole time he was gone. So I just wanted to make sure I added that. So he picked Sarah up, and she remembered him being upset or aggravated, complaining about Alyssa, and then tossed his cell phone to her and told her to try to call her sister. He explained that they had gotten into it, as they often did, because Alyssa wanted more freedom, and he refused. Of course, let's remember that Sarah was basically free to go and roam, okay? So again, he dropped her off at home to cool off, allegedly, supposedly. He said he had been trying to call her for hours, but she would not answer his calls. They got home, and Sarah immediately went to her sister's room and saw that Alyssa's backpack contents, the stuff that was in her bag, had just been dumped on the floor. Cell phone, everything there, but the backpack itself was missing. There was a note that Alyssa had left that read, quote, "Dad and Sarah, when you dropped me off at school today, I decided that I really am going to California. Sarah, you said you didn't want me around. Look, you got it. I'm gone. Dad, I took $300 from you. Alyssa." And an observation that I made when I saw the note, and I encourage you to Google and see the note for yourself, is that she most likely wrote it. Her handwriting is pretty unique, and I truly, truly do not believe that Michael could recreate it, okay? Now, was she forced to write the note? Probably. I would say most likely, but that's just my opinion. So Michael began calling Alyssa's friends and asking if she might be with them, but of course, we already know she wasn't. He called family members and told them that she was in actual danger. And then promptly around 11 p.m., he called the police. So she had been kind of missing, or he was trying to say that she had been missing from, you know, let's give him till noon after lunch or something until 11 o'clock p.m. before he calls the police. Interesting, to say the least. But when he called the police, it didn't really seem so intense because, you know, he just told them that he wanted to let them know that Alyssa was in California with her aunt and that he knew where she was. He said that she had stolen money from him, left a note, but he thought he'd better go right on ahead and report that. Again, flabbergasted. And because he said that, there was seemingly no reason to look for her. She was just listed as a runaway. Concerned neighbors were told to not bother looking for her. So we are supposed to believe that she just took off to California out of anger, not telling her best friends, not telling her rather serious for a high school boyfriend, her boyfriend, not even her beloved little sister. And yeah, they fought because they were, you know, adolescent girls, but, you know, they were very close and loved each other. She didn't even tell Sarah what she had planned on doing. Because sure, right? So a week goes by, and suddenly, Michael states he got a phone call from Riverside, California, from a payphone. He said that Alyssa was mumbling and cussing him out. She then told him to leave her alone, and she hung up. So when asked about whether he called the number back, he said that he hadn't, that he didn't think star 67 would work with long-distance numbers. And so, sidebar, if you don't know what star 67 is, that's what we in the United States, I'm not sure it's international, at least back in the day, we could hit star 67 and it would automatically redial the last number that called you in case you got like hang-ups or whatever. But then he also said later that he thought she might have called him from a local payphone. So if that were the case, first of all, why was she not in California and why didn't he star 67? You get what I'm saying? Holes all in his crap. He called the police the next day. He thought it prudent to tell them about Alyssa calling him. Later investigations would show that Michael had in fact received a phone call from Riverside, but there was no way to prove that it was Alyssa. He made these dramatic phone calls to family, you know, stating that he just knew something really bad had happened to her. He claimed to have driven back and forth to California, leaving flyers and asking the locals if they had seen her. And for reference, yes, Sarah says that she does remember her dad being gone off and on, but she didn't remember any of them having to do with traveling to Riverside, California. So some sources say that he took the last bit of money that she had out of her bank account from working and gave it to Sarah. Other sources say that the money was just sitting in there untouched. So I don't know which one is true. Sources say that he also pretty quickly got rid of her beloved pets. He told anyone that would hear it that the police were not helping him search for Alyssa. But we already know he told the police that he knew where she was. He told them, you don't need to look for her. She ran away. But the suspicions came pretty quickly because anyone who knew Alyssa knew she would have never left Sarah alone with their father. No way. For obvious reasons, but also because she had been taking it upon herself to try to care for Sarah because Michael didn't seem to care what was going on with his youngest daughter. But alas, she was just gone forever. There have been no hits on her social security number for employment or for a bank account, nothing, nothing. Anything that might link her to the real world anywhere just did not exist anymore after that date. Poof. Schrodinger's Alyssa, I guess you could say. She both exists and does not exist simultaneously. So the mind immediately goes to the constant surveillance going on in the house, right? Well, on that particular day, he said that he reviewed everything and that there was nothing of import. And so he erased the tapes. So nothing to watch or scan. Years went by, as they always do, and her disappearance began to garner a little bit of attention. Then in 2006, so 5 years, a self-proclaimed serial killer said he'd killed her, that she had been a heroin addict, and he said some other disgusting shit about her sexual habits. Now, everyone knew her, everyone that knew her, including her boyfriend, said that there was a zero possible chance that Alyssa had ever even tried heroin. Now, this alleged self-proclaimed serial killer was polygraphed, and he, of course, failed because he had never met her. And dots began to connect, and then all of a sudden it became quite clear that Michael was indeed their prime suspect. Now, at this point, Sarah was grown and got involved with the police in the disappearance of her sister. Police began actively searching for Alyssa. In 2008, so this is 7 years after she went missing, the police decided to get a warrant and search Michael's home. Now, from the site sippingonsomecrime.com, this is a direct quote. The investigative team was so nervous about serving him the warrant, knowing his paranoia and his personality, they were worried he would cause harm. He went out to check his mail one afternoon when the police approached him and detained him outside of the home. When they searched his body, he had 2 guns and 7 fully loaded magazines on his person. Once inside the home, they found much more. You see, they discovered disturbing videos of snuff pornography. Snuff pornography, sidebar, is where someone's being killed while in the act of coitus, if you will. And they found the contracts that Alyssa had signed stating she was not being sexually abused by her stepfather. They found tapes of phone calls with Michael speaking so poorly of Alyssa before and after her disappearance. This was not the way a, you know, supposedly loving father speaks of his daughter, especially a missing daughter. There was such a massive collection of videos from the home surveillance system and recorded phone calls from the passive recording system that in 2019, as of, there are still hundreds of hours of unwatched and unheard content. End quote. So the cops searched the house, right, except they found homemade pipe bombs, like a lot of them, okay? More than 2 dozen to be exact, along with 19 firearms, 2 homemade silencers, as well as a van full of gasoline. Yes, folks. And can you guess who the target was going to be for all of this? If you listen to part one, you know it's that goddamn union. Yeah, that pesky union who had stiffed Michael out of a job umpteen hundred years ago, right? They actually found a manifesto outlining Michael's plans for a brutal rampage against the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers building in Phoenix. He said it was in retaliation for them taking and killing Alyssa. He was, of course, immediately arrested, went to trial, and long story short, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison. So while it wasn't because of Alyssa and her disappearance, at least he was behind bars for 10 years. I mean, at least it's something. But he was eventually released in August of 2017. So this is 16 years after Alyssa went missing. Schrodinger's Alyssa, right? So Michael Turney emphatically denied the allegations of abusing Alyssa in any form or fashion or having anything to do with Alyssa's disappearance. He was interviewed and he told ABC News, once the whole country caught on to the case in 2009, he said, quote, "All I can say until hell freezes over, I didn't do a damn thing to my daughter," end quote. And yet, when Sarah point blank asked her father about it, he told her he would tell her on his deathbed? And even though Sarah was assured that when her father was released from prison, they would rearrest him immediately after for Alyssa's disappearance, that didn't happen. In fact, they told Sarah that her only real way of getting justice was to get the media's attention. And so she did. She talked to and still talks to anyone who will discuss it. I thought about contacting her and interviewing her for this, but I just kind of ran out of time. So, Sarah, if you're listening, love ya. Okay. She created her podcast, Voices for Justice, and in that process learned even more about her sister's case. At one point, Michael said that he had killed two union members, that goddamn union, you know, to avenge Alyssa's death, and said that they had buried her out in the desert in California. One of the gentlemen he claimed to have killed in his altercation, though, was a man who had been deceased far long before this incident would have allegedly occurred. So 3 years later, in the year 2020, Michael was officially and finally charged with Alyssa's murder, second-degree murder, 19 years after she disappeared. I keep saying that because I want to really press the ridiculous amount of time that has gone by since she's been gone. Sarah had started her podcast the year before, and sources say that she talks about it on TikTok as well. Cadaver dogs were used only once at the house they lived in, and the dog was only taken through the backyard. The older brothers all refused to participate in the search for their sister. This is what sources say. That is to say that they all believe Michael killed Alyssa, but most of them still want him in their lives. Sarah seems to be the only one who is really up to and willing to keep pushing this idea, the case. So the update that I had not been aware of, that is in 2023, all of the charges against Michael were dropped. Jurors heard 5 days of testimony from witnesses in the state's case, including two Phoenix Police Department detectives, Stuart Summershoe and William Anderson, and Alyssa's boyfriend at the time of her disappearance, Jonathan Lakeman, who, it was said, never moved on, never married, never had children. I mean, bless his whole heart, right? So according to NBC News, quote, the state rested their case on the sixth day of the trial, Monday, July 17th, after 2 days of testimony from Detective William Anderson. At that time, Michael Turney's defense attorneys, Jamie A. Jackson and Olivia Hicks, submitted a motion to the judge for an acquittal, citing Rule 20 of the Arizona Rules of Criminal Procedure, which states that, quote, the court must enter a judgment of acquittal if there is no substantial evidence to support a conviction, end quote. Defense attorney Olivia Hicks argued that the state did not present any physical evidence that Alyssa Turney is dead and that their client caused her death. In response to the defense's motion, Deputy County Attorney Vince Imbordino told the judge that Alyssa Turney had been a 17-year-old girl with family and friends, prized possessions, pets, you know, she would have been in contact with if she had been alive or if she were still alive. Judge Sam Myers ruled in favor of the defense and the jurors were relieved of their duty. All charges in the case against Michael Turney have been dismissed and he was released from custody on Tuesday, July 18th of last year, not even a year ago, as of this recording. But this means that he has spent 13 years behind bars. Is it justice? Absolutely not. But is it at least something? I mean, I guess so. NBC News wrote in an article, quote, they thanked the detectives from the Phoenix Police Department and the nonprofit organization Defenders of Children. They also thanked the true crime community. You became Alyssa's army and surrounded us both with love. I will never forget that, Sarah said. She also addressed her sister, Alyssa, directly. Quote, I love you, and I'm sorry, she said. You moved mountains to protect me from the reality of our lives so I could have the best childhood possible. That is something I can never repay you for. I just hope you know that I tried, and that you deserved so much better, end quote. Oh, that gave me goosebumps, seriously. James echoed Sarah's sentiments. James said, quote, like my sister, Sarah, my brother and I want to extend our thanks to all of you who have contributed in the process of trying to find justice for our sister, Alyssa, he said. This would not have happened without your dedication and support, end quote. Michael's current whereabouts are largely unknown, at least to the media, at least to Mr. Google. Now, I have to be kind of honest about this, right? Usually I can ferret out pretty quickly what's going on with these people, but this one had me stumped a little bit. You know, I have a friend who is a clinician, doc, shout out to you, who I kind of ran some ideas by, but then I was finally able to find what was going on. So what might be going on with Michael Turney psychologically is that he has actually been diagnosed with paranoid personality disorder. So let's look at that. Now, you guys that have been with me for a while know that I will look for any excuse to whip out my beloved DSM-5 that was gifted to me, and this case is no different. Paranoid personality disorder is included in the cluster A personality disorders that also include schizoid and schizotypal personality disorders. Cluster A's are called the odd eccentric cluster. But specifically when it comes to paranoid personality disorder, according to the DSM, the holy book of psychology aficionados, right, says that it is, quote, a pervasive distrust and suspiciousness of others such that their motives are interpreted as malevolent, beginning by early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts, as indicated by four or more of the following. So there are 7 points. They have to present with at least four, okay? So number one, suspects without sufficient basis that others are exploring, harming, or deceiving him or her. Is preoccupied with unjustified doubts about the loyalty or trustworthiness of friends or associates. Is reluctant to confide in others because of unwarranted fear that the information will be used maliciously against him or her. Reads hidden, demeaning, or threatening meanings into benign remarks or events. Persistently bears grudges, unforgiving of insults, injuries, or slights. Perceives attacks on his or her character or reputation that are not apparent to others and is quick to react angrily or to counterattack. And then the last point is has recurrent suspicions without justification regarding fidelity of spouse or sexual partner. And then that kind of jogs our memories, right? To go back to him, she's not allowed to have a boy in the house. She's not allowed to have a boyfriend. She can't have a girlfriend, you know, any of that kind of stuff. So it just seems like, you know, the suspicions without justification regarding fidelity of spouse or sexual partner. And we feel we're 99% sure that he was using her as a sexual partner. So paranoid personality disorder also does not occur exclusively during the course of schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depressive disorder with psychotic features, or another psychotic disorder, and is not attributable to the physiological effects of another medical condition. So that's just kind of saying that this does not occur exclusively during the course of other things going on. Okay. So Dr. Ramani, and if you look her up, you would recognize her immediately. She described paranoid personality disorder in a video, and she very much described things that exactly match the behaviors Michael displayed. Huge distrust, writing up contracts, wholly preoccupied with lawsuits as punishment for perceived wrongs, obsessed with Alyssa not having sex with anyone, male or female, managing his symptoms with extreme control, etc. So Dr. Daniel Fox, who also has a channel on YouTube, added to this that, and this was news to me, guys, we're going to learn together, borderline personality disorder very often goes hand in hand with paranoid personality disorder. So that is a comorbidity, as it were. And, you know, we've talked about BPD quite a bit, but an overview is that it resides in the cluster B personality disorders, which are marked by inappropriate, volatile emotionality, and often unpredictable behavior. The disorders in cluster B are antisocial, borderline personality, histrionic, and narcissistic personality disorder. And another sidebar is that I really want you guys to understand that everybody and their mental health or mental illness or whatever is going on with them, we all exist kind of on a spectrum, right? So some people might fit pretty neatly in a box with specific descriptors of symptoms, and others might just kind of show flavors. but not, you know, there can be some give, you know, it's all on a spectrum. I hope that makes sense. But anyway, borderline personality disorder includes a pattern of unstable, intense relationships, as well as impulsiveness and an unhealthy way of seeing themselves. Impulsiveness involves having extreme emotions or acting or doing things without thinking about them first. They have a strong fear of abandonment, often display a pattern of unstable or unhealthy relationships, and they sort of ride that roller coaster of how they perceive themselves or how they see themselves. They show impulsive and risky behavior, such as gambling, dangerous driving, unsafe sex, spending sprees, binge eating, drug misuse, or sabotaging success by suddenly quitting a good job or ending a positive relationship. So in response to fears of abandonment, separation, or rejection, they will threaten their own lives, and Michael certainly did a lot of that. They can display wild mood swings that last from hours to days. They have ongoing feelings of emptiness, along with inappropriate, strong anger, such as losing their temper often, being sarcastic or bitter, or physically fighting. And I think this is a fair assessment of Michael. So, paranoid personality disorder with either a comorbidity or at least a sprinkle of flavoring of borderline personality disorder, either way. So, I think you guys know where I stand. I think he killed her. I think he was sexually abusing her from a young age, and I think he knew that she was about to age out of that house, and then he would be exposed. I think that he knew his time was running out. She was going to get out of that house. She was going to tell people what he did and had been doing to her, and he couldn't allow that. And I think that is why he murdered her. What did he need all that lime and concrete for? You know what I'm saying? And this is clearly an unstable man who was going to bomb a electrician union building because he was trying to convince everyone that they had taken and killed Alyssa. Like, this guy is unhinged, absolutely unhinged. And then I know he spent 13 years in prison, and that is, again, it's something we can be thankful for that. But at the same time, all the charges were dropped. He was, you know, and I just find that absolutely insane because we have found people guilty without a body. You know what I mean? So I feel like even though he was in prison for 13 years, I still feel like he has gotten away with this. And it's absolutely horrible. This girl lived her whole childhood and adolescence being treated like a piece of garbage. You know, he would be so good and so sweet to his three other boys, plus John and Sarah, whom shared a biological mother with Alyssa, and yet she was treated so differently. Sarah, who is like 4 years younger than Alyssa, was allowed to just come and go as she pleased, smoke pot, drink, you know, take his pills, whatever, no big deal, right? Alyssa was micromanaged to the nth degree, controlled absolutely. And I feel like he's getting away with it. I really do. This whole case just absolutely sickens me. It sickens me. But again, I encourage you to go listen to Sarah's podcast, Voices for Justice. Tell her I said hi if you happen to go over there. Leave good comments and wish well for her, because I know that this has got to suck for her real bad. But outside of that, guys, as always, thank you so much for listening. Because I know you could be listening to anyone else, but you keep choosing me, and I really appreciate that, guys. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Yeah, anybody who killed more than two or three people was a mass murderer, and whether it was all at one place or over an extended period of time, and then in the early 80s, they came up with this differentiation called serial killing.